I'd like to open it up to questions from the floor. I have to remind the audience that this is being recorded for posterity and podcasting, so you can bear that in mind. And also to remind people to please phrase their questions in the form of a question, so that we can collect some questions and pass them up to the speakers up here. There's two microphones, and feel free to use either, and I will alternate between the two.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. My name's Dominic Mackley. I'm from the Office of the JAG. I want to thank all the presenters for their comments. They were very incisive, and I'd like them to comment on a suggestion I'm going to make. And thank you for the comment about the podcasting, because I'll make my own caveat to begin with. I'm not suggesting that that criminal justice models or criminal prosecutions are unimportant, okay? That's not what my question's about. My question's about its efficacy in dealing with modifying certain types of behavior. And I think Dr. Redgewood and Professor Cameron spoke about this in particular. If you can put your head into the idea of, okay, how effective are Western criminal justice systems models in modifying the behavior of terrorists? And I realize terrorist is arguably an unuseful term, but if you can consider that amongst those terrorists, that subset who we might refer to as true believers or the hardcore radicalists, those are the ones I'd like the panel to consider. And when you're considering the Western criminal justice models, Dr. Wedgwood made the point about the differences between these common law and this and the civil law systems. You can pick anyone you want in making your comment. Let's consider, first of all, the difficulty of securing a conviction in the Western systems. Particularly Canada and the United States, we have rules of evidence which are particularly difficult, making admissibility a very high standard to achieve. In addition to that, we have procedural safeguards which control the way matters can be argued and put before the court. And I suggest that I'm not going out on a limb to suggest that it's hard to secure a conviction. You have a very high standard to satisfy. Okay, but let's assume, for the sake of the question, that you have secured a conviction. And then the question is, all right, does the terrorist, the true believer, feel any shame, moral or otherwise, for having been convicted by a Western court? And you can add whatever adjective you want to describe what they might how they might describe that court. Then the next question is, is there any punishment in the range of punishments that would reasonably be perceived as being punitive by these folks? And I would include capital punishment in that range of punishments. I suggest to you that as far as the true believers are concerned, there is not any punishment in all punishments which are available to us, which they would be, where they can reasonably be expected to perceive as punitive. So if you see the very high standard for conviction, the effectiveness of the punishments, I'd like the panel to comment, or those who are interested in commenting, on whether it's realistic for us to expect that Western criminal justice systems can modify the behavior of terrorists.
Dr. Wedgwood, in an earlier article, wrote about one of the purposes of criminal law, as I recall, was stigma and punishment. Is that the phrase you used in Foreign Affairs? I think that was one of the things you said. Denial. Okay. I think stigma and punishment are a real problem in counterterrorism. I think denial is a feasible objective. I think deterrence probably is not a terribly feasible objective, except in the tactical sense. I think strategic level deterrence is a problem. I don't think, for example, the 9/11 attack was deterrable in the sort of meta sense. I think you can look to interdict individuals, and if there is a high probability that individuals will be interdicted, it becomes a less appealing option. There isn't that much glory, really, in being the guy who gets arrested before you've actually done anything significant. So if there's a high probability that you are going to be that person, that seems to me to offer some level of tactical deterrence. Is it perfect? No, of course it isn't. I've talked about 9/11. But even if you look at what happened in the UK, the July 7th bombing, you know, you're not going to get interdiction every time, therefore you're never going to have perfect deterrence, even at the tactical level. It seems to me, though, that one of the advantages of a robust legal regime is that other countries have them as well. And one of the things that we know about terrorists is that there's an element of target transfer. If you are the country that has a weak regime, at least theoretically, you are, or hypothetically, you are a more plausible target, you're a more feasible target than the folks next door who have a more robust regime.
I take the point, if you could, if I may use a French word, if you can show that the would-be terrorist is a schlemoil, he doesn't know how to do his own thing right. He's sort of painfully, shamefully incompetent. Maybe that kind of shame would work. Certainly, if I was arguing a case like this to a jury of any mixed heritage or even plain Anglo-Saxon British Columbians, I would be inclined to ground the accusation not just in the common law, but in the traditions of Sharia and of the law of war, as explicated by Kaddouri, and both certainly the right to spare women, children, old people, and maybe even the duty to spare them. It's all to the good to show that this is a universal set of impulses. But push to shove, I think what you're really looking for in criminal law is incapacitation, not deterrence, in fact. There's a lot of interest in what the Saudis are doing. My friend Jessica Stern at Harvard is running around looking at this. But the ability of Western countries to give people wives and clans is rather different. And even the Saudis have a 20% failure rate. And there's no particular showing that this program slows down the rate of recruitment. There's also just an interesting problem in proving cases. My friend Ken Roth, who now runs Human Rights Watch, we're often at loggerheads on particular issues, he used to be a prosecutor back when I was a prosecutor. He was a counterterrorism prosecutor. He did the third generation of the Kathy Boudin gang, which the FBI took down, arrested, before they could actually do the attempted jailbreak from the Brooklyn House of Detention. And the Bureau took it down because they didn't want blood in the streets. They figured if they waited until the shootout happened with the prison guards in Brooklyn, somebody would get killed. So they took it down. They had a bunch of paralegal and a parasocial and all kinds of professionals who were involved in this out of misplaced sympathy. And the jury didn't see any blood. Judge didn't see any blood. Lost the RICO count, the racketeering count. Had a couple gun counts. All the parapersons got probation. One argument would be that the judge was saying, look, get straight, kids. I don't even take you seriously as a revolutionary. You're a social worker. Go back to be a social worker. I disdain you as you're a failed revolutionary. But I think from the point of view of law enforcement, the frustration sometimes is that if the event hasn't been consummated, but something disastrous happening, then a jury has a very different emotional reaction, even perhaps a judge, and is not inclined to take it seriously as to where it might have led. And that fine line between having a shootout and having something that is not sanguinary, but that a jury and judge would take seriously is one that's very difficult for law enforcement. One thing I think is worth doing, it's a funny little technical project, but I do think criminal prosecutions could be enhanced if one went around and highlighted some of the idiosyncrasies of countries that they might want to rethink. For example, the Brits do not admit wiretaps into court in evidence, ever, at all, not know-how, supposedly because the intelligence services don't want to be constrained. It's not that hard to go to intelligence court and get yourself a warrant. And in the case of the attempted airport bombing, I take it perhaps that some of the defendants against whom a case could not be proved might have been assisted, the cases might have been assisted by wiretap evidence. That's something I think the Brits should rethink. The Pakistanis will never admit a confession on the stated ground that the police services are so violent that you could never be assured that any confession was voluntary. Well, hell, then videotape them. And so I think actually you could get improvement in the criminal justice performance of a lot of countries if you carefully, it's the kind of micro-knowledge that certainly doesn't count in academia, but I do think that one could make helpful suggestions to particular countries on how they could increase their ability to respond with criminal justice. Second and thirdly, define crimes farther upstream. It's what you do with burglar stools. It's what you do with buying explosives without a license. And you can stay within a criminal justice paradigm and by not necessarily demanding that the prohibited act be so close to the meta harm that you want to avoid. But no, I think the real issue here is how do you have the debate within Islam? What happens to Salafist movements? What's the life cycle? I think this kind of devotion to violence happens in societies every so often for different reasons and until there's dismay and abandonment. And how, but one can't have this argument for Islam without being Muslim. I think the lack of authenticity is a huge problem, and therefore it's something that one hopes one's Muslim friends will undertake as their own kind of moral contribution.
Just a quick response, because I know there are people at mics, but one of my answers would be you don't always know, I don't think, if Western criminal justice has had a deterrent effect, and particularly outside of the al-Qaeda radical Islamist area, I think it's less likely to have a deterrent effect with al-Qaeda and adherents than it is with some other terrorist groups. And the reason I say you don't always know is based on our own experience. We were, as you know, a hotbed of Sikh separatism. The Khalistan movement was centered in various parts of Quebec, Ontario, and particularly British Columbia in the 1980s. Were responsible for the largest terrorist attack in history before 9/11 in terms of the number of people who died, 331. It did peter up fairly quickly over at least a decade. Did aggress not just criminal justice, because many of the prosecutions, as you know, were unsuccessful, including the most recent one, but aggressive law enforcement action, a lot of public attention to the phenomenon, certainly a presence of law enforcement and intelligence within the communities where the Khalistan movement were active. But was that a factor in the petering out of the Khalistan movement, particularly in the Vancouver area? Was it other factors in India and in the actions of the Indian government, in the leadership of the Khalistan movement based in India? Who knows? I tend to think that there was some impact in that particular case.
I've been told we've got 10 extra minutes till 12:40. What I'd like to do is take the three persons at the mic, take questions from each of you, and then have the panel address all three questions. Thank you.
I guess I'll introduce myself since I didn't last time. Barbara Falk from the Canadian Forces College in Toronto. Just a quick comment. I don't think we should be really surprised by the fact that the discussion we're having this morning primarily is a legal discussion, because post 9/11, that's how we responded. We passed a whole bunch of laws. There's a bunch of Security Council resolutions. There's lots of quasi things happening. So, you know, almost a decade later, it's a legal discussion. So that leads me to my plea, which is that the political scientists, which I think mostly dominate this room, should be having a lot more conversations with people who are actually dealing with the legal side of it. So kudos to Carlton for bringing us together, but I think that has to keep happening. My question, in a sense, built upon the JAG question from earlier, which maybe even goes one step further, also taking into account some of what Professor Wedgwood just said. We've got all of these sort of overlaps and contradictions and problems, whether it's, you know, deportation to torture or issues of disclosure or how to deal with evidence law, you know, international humanitarian law versus human rights law, which law applies where, both how. Or even more important perhaps in this country, also in the U.S., is the extent to which immigration law has been used as a proxy for criminal law post-9/11. Given all of this, would we have, now we've got almost a decade of hindsight, would we have been better off post-9/11 if we just not reacted so quickly by all of these various measures, the use of security certificates in Canada, the jump to make new terrorism provisions in the criminal code? Would we have been better off if we had just looked issue by issue, you know, what kinds of, you know, evidence and disclosure standards do we need? And I know, like, what kinds of, I mean, I know ATA was an omnibus bill, and one of the things it did was, you know, amend the Canada Evidence Act. But if we had just taken issue by issue some of these legal, you know, conundrums as they arose, rather than create these, new statutes that have now created all of these extra problems, and all of these tricky little litigation questions, which, if anything, have made it even harder for the public to be part of the conversation. Margaret Purdy talked about the illiteracy of Canadians. Well, that's because this is really, really hard to sort out. It's hard for people to understand. And the more layers of law we put on this, the harder and harder it gets to understand, and people become more and more removed, and, by the way, more and more susceptible to just, you know, media sensationalization of threats, which doesn't really help the conversation at all. I'll stop there.
Thank you, I'm Marco Sassoli. Just with two small testimonies from Europe, first for Ruth Wedgwood and her description of the civil law system. I think, well, in Europe, often some people, not I, describe in a similar way the common law system are somehow shocking for them. Some fairness issues, like it depends whether you have how much you can pay to your lawyer, or also plea bargaining was traditionally incredibly shocking, but now many Roman, German tradition countries have adopted it. So I think systems can also learn from each other, and one should never assume that international human rights law corresponds to the domestic requirements of one or the other system. So obviously, I don't know whether this is possible, but under international law, certainly the common law system could be modified to be more realistic for these things, and human rights law is, even in the European system, the European Court of Human Rights is quite flexible on issues. It never asks impossible things, and I think this is preferable than to put some issues simply completely out of the protective system to adapt the system to new threats, as it was done in Germany or Italy when there were terrorist threats. A small remark to Gavin Cameron, with whom I agreed on everything, just a little exception to your rule that the weakest system will be the most threatened. I can report to you, in the whole legal order of Switzerland, the word terrorism, terrorist act, appears only once, and this is in connection with financing, because the Security Council has obliged us. But for the rest, I don't think there are more terrorist threats against Switzerland than against other countries. You can't compare it with the US, obviously, but say Canada is, in my view, comparable in the sense that it's not really the target, but it's around. And I think with all the legislation you have, nevertheless, the threat situation is very similar. Thank you.
Thanks. My name is Maura Johnson. I'm with the Department of Foreign Affairs. You've spoken quite a lot about criminal law in addressing terrorism, but I just wanted to get back quickly to the issue of economic measures, which a couple panelists raised, that is UN sanctions targeting the financial flows of named individuals and entities. And just wondered if any who care to could comment on the extent to which that has been effective at all or somewhat in addressing or preventing terrorist acts. Thank you.
What to say? Should we have not reacted so quickly? I guess one could argue that. But there were people who did invade Afghanistan, and one had to figure out what to do with the folks who were captured there. Although one student of mine from a allied power had a wonderful seminar on law of armed conflict last semester, with no lawyers, just operators, told me that in his first 6 months in Afghanistan, they were carefully instructed not to capture anybody because they didn't know what to do with them. Call the Americans who would do something bloody-minded and just surround the guy and hand him over. Shipriders, as we call them now, in the Gulf of Aden. So with given the desire to displace the Taliban so that you would displace the hosting for al-Qaeda, there were immediate issues that needed to be addressed. And although I was not privy to them, I take it from the public press, there were very alarming intelligence spikes in October of 01. True or false? No one knew where AQ Khan had sold his wares. And according to the public press, there actually was, grounded or not, an intelligence spike about having a nuclear weapon in North America. Nobody knew whether Russians had left suitcase bombs. I certainly knew from my Georgian friends that everything was for sale in Mother Russia. Battleships. Apparently one battleship made its way to one of the Scandinavian countries as a salvage item. So there was fear, I think, that proliferation of weapons of mass destruction plus the uncertain architecture of al-Qaeda really did create a very explosive situation that needed some immediate address, and the issue was how to do it. But I do take the point that one has to sit down and think about it soberly. Common lawyers tend to be particularly entrenched in their ways, Magna Carta and all that. And what would King John say if we were to change things from the 1215? So we're not willing to think that civil law has anything to offer. And then at heart, we're all liberals. The conservatives in North America are liberals, in fact. I mean, we just presume that the state should keep the hell away from you until it can really prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you're a bad actor. And it's so entrenched, call it, whether it's situation comedies or Perry Mason or Earl Stanley Gardner or cop shows, it's just assumed to be a ontological fact of the universe that this is the way you try a case. And I do think trial lawyers are the best applied epistemologists of anybody I've ever met. How do you know what you think you know? We're very good at that. We are the ultimate moral skeptics. But it's not the basis of information upon which people act in most decisions in their own lives. And therefore, I take Marco's point that there may be something to be learned from the civil law system about other ways to try cases. But the two methods of trial do probably reflect very deep-seated attitudes toward public authority. My old Yale colleague Dimashka's book about faces of justice, that there may be a greater trust in bureaucratic processes and civil law systems than in common law systems. But one wants that popular voice of the jury and the defiance of the defense lawyer to keep the state in check. Maura Johnson's question, I'm not quite sure I entirely understood it. All I can tell you is my general impression is that the targeting of financial flows has been very ineffective. Here, Switzerland could make a contribution, along with restoring to the developing world the funds stolen by their erstwhile leaders sitting in UBS or whatever, allegedly, or in Liechtenstein or in Jersey. Financial transparency would be a very good thing, not just to restore looted public aid to the third world, but as well to make it easier to follow these kinds of financial flows. The informal banking system, though, makes this very difficult. There are many countries that don't hue to ideas of transparency on this. So there's a limit to what you can do. And where I do differ with my friend David Sanger from last night is certainly prosecutors know that even if logically a bad actor should know something, they often don't. They forget. It's only when they're stupid and make goofy mistakes that you catch them. So that, in fact, it's vice and virtue. The virtue of the press is it keeps government honest. The vice of the press is that they're not responsible for public security. They don't feel responsible for it particularly. And therefore, you often do have things that would be very valuable if you could use them as techniques without abuse before they are made public instantaneously. And the counterterrorism official I referenced yesterday said that there almost now is an impulse, kind of a scratch, an itch needs a scratch. If it's secret, it must be immediately leaked because the public has a right to know. And while I don't like the UK State Secrets Act, I do prefer the American tradition of openness, but it's very tough to be an operator, I think, and have any efficacy when you know that any attention-seeking colleague on the left or right will immediately call up the Washington Post and tell them. So it's very difficult. I know this sounds terribly totalitarian to say this, but it's hard to be the government. Remember James Scott's book, How to Think Like a State? The government is, strangely enough, often the underdog because it's expected to provide certain public goods, and it's very hard to provide those goods.
Just a couple of responses to the first question, would we have been better off going issue by issue as opposed to omnibus? I think I'm correct in saying that most of the Canadian legal issues, the ones certainly that I referred to, don't stem at all from the Anti-Terrorism Act. Some do, and there's been certainly some adjustment to that act, both in terms of the sunset clauses and in the definition of terrorist activity that I think most people would observe are both appropriate. Many of the issues flow rather from the security certificate process, which was in existence long, long before 9/11. In fact, was used against terrorists successfully in some cases before 9/11. Third point, I would say there are police officers in this room who I think would say we would not have had all and perhaps any of the prosecutions we've had in the Khwaja case and other cases without the Anti-Terrorism Act in place. We didn't need the whole act, you're right, but I guess that also brings me to something that Gavin started off by saying, which is that some decisions at some points in time are political, not legal or strategic, and if you're a country living next door to the United States on 9/11, you have to make all three choices, what you need legally, what you need strategically, but importantly, what is politically going to be the priority in terms of legislation. I say finally that from being inside government at that time, there had long been recognized the requirements for new and different powers, particularly for the police, to deal with the phenomenon of terrorism that the Criminal Code did not provide. The Canada Evidence Act had long been recognized as needing modernization, conundrums that were frustrating prosecutions. And file that I worked on for far too long, the Official Secrets Act, which I think was about 60 years old at the time that it was modernized, desperately needed modernization. And through the omnibus bill kind of scenario, you do have the opportunity, and those opportunities don't come along very often, to present Parliament with a body of legislation that either needs to fill gaps that exist or need to modernize legislation that desperately needs upgrading.
I would like to thank Ruth especially, but also Margaret, Gavin, and Jane for an excellent discussion here. If you could just join me in thanking them. Thank you.